state of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Morning, we're delighted to welcome you for a hearing in the matter of 0704, the amendment of SCR 40.04, legal competence. You may be seated too.
Thank you, Chief.
Legal competence requirement bar examination, SCR 40.04, sub 5. And the presenter is Mr. Arnold A. Moncada, Jr. You may proceed.
Honorable Justices.
Good morning.
May it please the Court. My name is Arnold Moncada. I'm the petitioner for the proposed amendment, and I live in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. I'm speaking here today to support the proposed amendment and briefly explain the rationales for the petition and the research. First, I'd like to state to the Court that this is not a challenge to the diploma privilege. I have no issue with that whatsoever. As a matter of fact, my son Richard was a recipient of that, and this very courtroom in May of 1994 was sworn in. So that's not an issue.
There's a suit pending, I think, in federal court on that, so we don't have to worry about that for the moment.
Thank you, Judge. I do mention the diploma privilege in my rationale, though, as far as the balancing and even the playing field in regards to taking the bar exam and no limitation. If I may address the Court as far as give a brief background of my background, would that be proper? Can I do that?
Proceed, please.
Okay. Judge, I'm retired sheriff from Waukesha County. I spent 28 years in law enforcement. I worked my way through the ranks and became the sheriff of Waukesha County. During that tenure, I also worked like 5 years as a bailiff at every circuit court and with the commissioners. And at that point, every aspect of law you can mention, we went through that. I ended up actually being in charge of the Court Services Division, which was the criminal, civil aspect. In the old days, we did the replevins, the foreclosures, the writ of executions, and so forth. And then I retired, and as my petition states, my goal was to go to law school and work with my son. I attended Thomas Cooley Law School, which is a difficult law school, as well as Marquette and University of Wisconsin. I'm not debating how law schools are, but at Thomas Cooley, it's easier to get into the school, but very difficult to get out, to graduate. And I did that 3 years and did my apprenticeship in Milwaukee. The goal here is that we need a system that's fair and reasonable. And all through law school, you hear that verbiage, the reasonable person standard. And I've heard that all the way through, all through the courts, all the years I worked in the courts. And that's what I'm asking today, reasonable. There's three specific issues in the petition that I address. And the one is no limitation on taking the bar exam.
Now there's a limitation of, what, 3? Mm-hmm. And then if you can ask for taking a 4th, is that it?
Just correct,
remind me. I've read the materials, but...
No, you're correct. It's 3 times, and then you can request to the Board of Bar Examiners as permission, and they ask you to provide a study plan. Mm-hmm. The concerns that I have is going through this process is that when they do that, there's no, we're not sure of the criteria. They go into closed session, and we have no idea how they set the criteria as to how many times you can take the exam. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the disturbing things I had.
Okay, so you don't want a limit on the number.
No limit on the number.
No limit on the number. Okay.
And in my research, I contacted the National Conference of Board Bar Examiners, which is located here in Madison, and they provide an annual report. And in 2004, I looked at that report, and I think you have an exhibit number 1 in regards to the states that have no limitation. I went on the computer and looked at it just the other day, and they've added a state. There was 30 states in the union that have no limitation, and Mississippi has just joined those ranks. So there's 31 states in the District of Columbia that have no limitation, and that's Exhibit 1. And I do have the 2007 sheet that the court does not have. They have a 2006, but 2007 shows Mississippi.
All right. What's the other thing you you want to change. So you want to change that there's no limit on the number of times. Okay.
Yes, Judge.
And you don't want a three times and then you need special permission. You don't want the special permission.
No, Judge.
Okay. What's the second thing you want?
I wanted to address that I did contact the Wisconsin Department of Regulation and Licensing. There's hundreds of thousands of licenses in Wisconsin, as you well know. There's no limitation. On October 15th, I made contact with the department and talked to a gentleman by the name of Darren Teschner, and I asked for three specific licensings. There's numerous, but I asked him about pharmacists. And I said, is there a limitation in regards to taking the exam? And he said, no, there's not. Also, accountants, there's no limitation. Chiropractors, no limitation. Basically, there's no limitation with the Department of Regulation. Mm-hmm. If there is, after so many exams, they would have someone do, like, say, if you fail three or four times, there were remedial studies, but there is no specific limitation in regards to having no one take. For me, today, as I stand here today, I can never take the bar exam again.
As I understand these filings, if someone does not pass in three times and they're given permission to take it again, there's a course of remedial study. Was that
for the bar exam?
Yeah.
You prepare a study plan mm-hmm. for the board to review, okay. and then you follow that study plan, and then you actually sign an affidavit that you followed that. And then
you
they,
did that?
Yes, I did.
Okay. On the 4th, and what about on the 5th? Did you do that too?
Yes.
Okay.
And on the issue, Judge, is on the 4th, I did a 142 on the MBE, which is very good. I passed 6 of the 8 essay
yep.
questions. And the grading, no disrespect, Mr.
Kasabaki.
Has addressed in his opposition is that they go in increments of anything below 7.5, right. they evaluate that.
Well, that's the passing grade, they say.
Yes. I had 6 of 8, and the last two were 7s.
Mm-hmm.
And before I forget that, this first thing, today they reduced the standards again. Today they actually reduced them to lower the standards.
In what way?
Pardon?
In what way?
The scores. My understanding is that they used to take a combined total. They would do the MBE and they would do the SA and combine that to a total of 258 as their scoring. Now it's just one score, 258. Well, on my 4th exam, I have 269.
Mm-hmm.
So in today's standards, I would have passed that exam. And as long as we're on that, I researched it, went back, and Mr. Rankin provided information as well as the Board of Bar Examiners that the board has increased. First of all, they increased the scoring several times from 127 to 128 and then to 129. As when I took it, it was 129. Now, as of today, as we stand here, they've reduced it. It's 123 on the essay portion and 135 on the national exam.
I'm sorry, my memory isn't good enough over the years. But there's an explanation for that change of scoring depending on, I think, how the examination fared nationally or in the state. But we'll let Mr. Kasabaki see if my recollection
that,
is correct. Okay, go ahead. What's your third point, Mr.
Okay.
Moncada?
The third point is my second point, Judge, is because I've gone through as far as the licensing, is an appeal process.
Okay.
There is no due process here. I mean, the board meets in closed session, and they make their determination. This board does not abide by open records, open meetings law. It's an arm of the court, and there's an attorney general opinion that says they don't have to abide by that. So they go into their closed session and make their decisions. Again, very disturbing and frustrating after working in the system all these years that that's what happens. I had requested a hearing before the board, and they make the decision, the arbitrary decision, on their own. If they don't think it's valid, then you don't have an opportunity to do it. I can't appeal any of this to any board because I'm an applicant taking a bar exam. If I'm challenging my character and fitness, then I could do that. Then there could be an issue. But in this process,
who do you want to appeal to? As I read your materials, first, who do you want to appeal to?
in several states where they have the no limit, mm-hmm. If you fail the exam within a certain frame, with say 1 to 5, they have an appeal. The board has the hears the appeal.
This is on the grading, because you only have the graders do it, so you want a grading question appeal to the BBA. Okay.
Yes, Judge. The rules are set by the court. The court initiates the rules, and the board puts them in place. And that's what my request is, that at least have the opportunity to appeal that. And right now there is none. That's
right.
That. And then the third issue is retroactivity, as far as that this no limitation and the appeal process be retroactive, so at least I would have an opportunity to have someone look at my exam. Because I said, as today, the fourth exam, I would have passed today's standards.
Do you want the retroactivity so that you can appeal to the board because of a prior exam, or you want retroactivity so in the future you can take exams? You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
It's twofold. I understand.
On both. Okay.
Yes. Yes, Judge. I want both.
Thank you. When was the last time you took the exam?
2005.
Okay. The reason
they don't know. I'm trying to think.
Yeah. Well, we can figure that out. The reason I say that is I will ask Mr. Kasabucky, if I remember. If not, I hope he volunteers whether your exams are still there, because they usually destroy them after a year, is my understanding, at least from the documents I've got.
I would like to make one point as far as the schools. And the reason I'm asking for this, it evens the playing field with the diploma privilege. At Marquette University, you can take a part-time program 4, 5, and 6 years and not take a bar exam.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard the Chief Justice mentioned many times, you don't remember what you did a year or 2 years ago with all the cases you do. But here, after 6 years...
6 months.
I thought that was just me, Judge, but I guess... And another big issue is my biological clock is ticking, Judge. I can't... I may be 80 years old if you do decide just to take the bar exam, but...
Never too old.
That's what I say.
But better sooner than later. That's what you also say.
Yes.
Okay. I understand that.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I understand that, and that's fine.
I just wanted to make that point, and I have nothing against, I have no ill will against anyone in regards to that. I just feel that, but I've worked in the system, I've been in the system, and I think this is a fair and just and reasonable that they set the system up that way. And it evens the playing field for the diploma privilege. If someone, even if it is challenged, you can say, well, how can you challenge it? There's no limitation in taking the bar exam. You can take as many times as you want. And there is an appeal process. And I listened to some of the audio tapes from other rulings where they came in and you addressed those. And all through those hearings, I hear reasonable is fair. I mean, that's all part of the process. And I'm just asking for that today in this petition. So I think that's all I have, Judge. And I just want to make... do I have an opportunity to address the opposition as far as afterward?
May.
Should do
you
that
may.
Afterwards,
yes.
Judge?
You
okay.
Will.
Thank you very much.
And should I forget, please rise. That's 5 minutes. Please rise and tell me that. You should be able to respond.
Okay.
And I appreciate that you're using the system to make your wishes known and... I put the matter before the court.
I keep saying one more statement, but it was ironic going through this. It was not only frustrating, but when I worked in the courts, I met a lot of lawyers, and now our assistant DAs are judges. Most people have no idea there was a limitation on the bar exam. I mean, judges.
Because they didn't take it.
They didn't take it, and they said they're glad they didn't. But it was ironic because if it doesn't involve you, you're not going to pay attention to it. So. Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mancata. I show here as the only other appearance, Mr. Kasabucky. Is there anyone else who wants to appear? Okay, hearing none. I don't have a list. That will be you, Mr. Kasabucky. The court has your materials and has read them.
Chief Justice Abramson, distinguished members of this honorable court, may it please the court. It's a distinct honor to be here again, somewhat different from the last time I was here. But I'm pleased to be here to present the position of the Board of Bar Examiners on this petition that's before you. As I have already provided a detailed position paper to you, I will try to be brief and highlight some of the key provisions. The purpose of the bar admissions is to protect the public by assuring that only competent, qualified individuals are admitted to the bar. Competence can be demonstrated in several ways: the diploma privilege, application on foreign license, or the bar examination. The bar exam itself is designed to test minimal competence of the applicants. The word minimal is the key word and very important. An applicant who has failed to demonstrate minimal competence after multiple attempts should not be provided unlimited attempts at the exam. After all, the public has no way of knowing how many times an applicant has failed an exam before becoming licensed. And I think that's important for our public. Further, the overall national bar examination passing rate for repeaters is only 36%, compared to a passing rate of first-time takers of 76%.
Well, the passing rate also differs as the number of times you've taken the exam, doesn't it?
Yes,
okay,
ma'am.
Go ahead.
Now, that other jurisdictions may provide unlimited attempts at passing the bar exam is not necessarily what is best for the people of the state of Wisconsin. The vice chair of our board, Attorney James Morrison, has wisely stated, and I quote, "As a matter of protecting the general public, we should not give licenses to practice law to individuals who have repeatedly failed the bar examination because they either finally get it right or get lucky on one attempt. The people of Wisconsin deserve attorneys who have demonstrated their competence, not lucky ones. While persistence may be a virtue in many aspects of life, the license to practice law is a right, not a privilege, given to individuals who have demonstrated they will do no harm by their incompetent practice. In matters of licensing, we should err on the side of protecting the public rather than giving unlimited attempts at taking the bar exams. We believe this is reasonable and fair. Under the current Supreme Court rules, an applicant may take the bar exam three times as a matter of right. A fourth attempt requires the approval of the board. An applicant must develop and submit a comprehensive study plan of not less than 160 hours and be supervised by a Wisconsin licensed attorney. And the board has taken a liberal approach as to what those study plans can consist of. In the approximately 18 months since I've been the full-time director of the board has approved all such plans that have come before it. Some of them showed a calendar with the with times listed on there for individual study. Some showed that they would be taking national courses such as PMBR or the Barbary courses. But the board has taken a very liberal approach on what constitutes a study plan. And as Mr. Moncada has stated, upon completion of that plan, the applicant must provide an affidavit averring that he has completed that plan, that study plan, and it must also be provided with an affidavit by the supervising attorney that he has supervised the plan and the applicant has completed the plan.
Mr. Kasabuki, so we've got the fourth and you've got a study plan and the person takes the exam and doesn't pass it. What do you do on the fifth application?
Well, under the current rules, the fourth time is it.
All right.
But our
no
board,
exceptions?
Well, our board has taken the position that they will exercise its discretion, and in the case of Mr. Moncada, they allowed him to take a bar exam for a fifth time.
On what basis does the board exercise its discretion?
The board will look and has indicated that they will look at such things as has an individual made progress on the bar exam attempts. They will look at what amount of time has passed between bar exams. and they will look at the reasonableness. They may look in the future as such things as increasing the number of hours in the study plan to provide an applicant whatever is necessary to allow him to accomplish the objective of providing minimal competence.
Mr. Kazabucki, if you require a study plan, how do you know, unless someone signs up for a national plan, which has worked for many lawyers throughout the United States, how do you know that their study plan is going to do a darn thing toward getting them through to the past the bar?
We look at what they put on the plan. For example, if they indicate on Monday between 8 and 10, I'm going to be studying, for example, torts. The afternoon, I'm going to be studying whatever. I'm going to be reviewing tests that I have had in law school. We cannot guarantee you what they're going to study or if they are actually going to study what they say they are, but they have to aver and sign an affidavit that they did complete the study plan.
Has the board ever considered that if someone who's had difficulty passing it agrees to take a national study plan, that they will then permit that person to have yet another try?
If they indicate that in the study plan, that's certainly their prerogative.
I guess I'm not saying it will. I have concerns about whether someone who's not passing knows what kind of study plan they need. Okay? And I don't know what criteria the board would have for deciding what kind of study plan is sufficient. My own experience is really from a family member. One of my daughters has taken the bar in 4 states, if you can imagine, including Wisconsin, and she has always taken a national study plan. And she's passed the first time on every exam, from California to Texas to Minnesota to Wisconsin. So there's got to be something going on with those study plans that are commercially prepared and that you attend and do the work on that seems to be helpful throughout a lot of states. And I'm just wondering if the board is maybe in its consideration of study plan requirements isn't being realistic on saying, well, yeah, we'll let you take it again if you have a study plan. But if they don't know that the study plan has any chance of success, perhaps we're just setting folks up to fail again. And I guess I'm wondering if the board has done any kind of its own internal review of what kinds of study plans seem to lead to success.
We have looked at that. The position of the board is that we don't want to get into the business of endorsing any type of national study plans that are out there besides Barbary and PMBR, which has now been...
Just a minute. We generally don't refer to Barbary or PLI or any of these other as study plans. These are preparatory for the bar exam. What you do in the study plan is different. It is a self-imposed attempt to prepare for the examination. So let's, just so that we don't confuse our terminology, you don't require them to take a bar preparation course.
We do not require it, but that can be a part of their individualized study plan.
And if they say they're going to do that, you might approve that.
That is correct, and we have approved that in the past.
As part of their study plan?
Yes, ma'am. Oh,
okay.
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
Here comes a time, though, if an individual has failed to demonstrate minimal competence, even after following a comprehensive study plan, it's questionable whether they can ever demonstrate the minimal competence.
See, my concern was more to whether the board, and you may have already done this, has looked at the kinds of study plans that have been put together and for its own self determined this seems to be working for a number of people, but this kind of a plan that doesn't work. For example, if you say, I'm going to study torts for 4 hours every Monday morning. Mm-hmm. Well, studying torts is, I mean, what about torts? What parts of torts are you studying? How are you studying it? You know, what materials are you using? I would think it would be very difficult for the board to evaluate the efficacy of a study plan put together by a novice who's having trouble taking the bar. And I guess I'm just wondering, is that a criteria that has meaning, or is it really meaningless? That's my concern.
The study plans are totally individualized. If we have 10 people submitting study plans, we have 10 different types of study plans.
Right, but do you know what... I'm doing a bad job this morning. What I'm concerned with is, does the board know, when it approves a study plan,
that it has a significant chance of aiding the person who puts it forth. If the board has never studied what kinds of things lead to success, I don't know how they can say, yes, this is okay. I mean, if you just say okay to any study plan, to me, you're setting someone up for failure that's already had a hard time and has not been able to pass. So has the board ever studied what kinds of study plans lead to success for those that have had problems in the past?
We have not looked formally at what other types of study plans may help, but we do look, or the board does look, in detail at the individual study plans that are presented.
I understand that, and I congratulate you on that. I think that's good. My concern is, how do you, even though you look at them in detail, how do you know what you're seeing in regard to its chances of helping the applicant? That's my concern.
Understandable.
Mr. Buckey, I've got a very different question. The materials that were given to us indicate that your rules committee and your board has apparently approved a change in the rules so that the special permission to take the bar exam beyond number 3 no more than once, those words would be eliminated. Now, how does that fit with your opposition here to the proposal that's being made?
The board did consider that at its October 19th meeting and is in the process of finalizing a complete packet of proposed changes to Chapter 40. That was one of the proposals that they were considering, and in fact, we're looking at it favorably to submit to the court. What that would do would, in effect, do what the board is already doing and looking at requests to take a bar exam beyond the fourth time that is in the current appendix to Chapter 40. So what it, in effect, would just be doing what the board is already doing and looking at additional attempts at a request by an individual. The board doesn't want to get into a situation, for example, in California, where somebody has taken and failed a bar exam 30 or 40 times. I just came back from a national conference. They had an individual who failed a bar exam 60 times, passed it on the 61st time, and within a year and a half, he was before their equivalent of the OLR. So the board would use its discretion on requests for an attempt to take a bar exam beyond the fourth time, but they feel that there has to be a finality in the system if the individual applicant cannot demonstrate minimal competence.
So this particular petitioner could come back to you if this rule is approved and ask to take it yet again. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
And will your new appendix to Chapter 40 set forth the elements of how you exercise discretion so that an applicant can evaluate those and then submit materials for you?
Ma'am, that is an outstanding suggestion, and I will take it to the board and assure that we include it in the appendix.
All right. Another question I have for you is there's a complaint here in some of the documents, I think by Mr. Moncada, that you stop people from coming to your meetings that might be open because they don't deal with specific. I mean, obviously, when you compose bar exam questions, you can't have that open. That defeats the whole purpose of the bar. You can't have you don't want to have discussions of individuals because that's a confidentiality privacy issues. But when you're discussing rules, when you're discussing other matters, do you adhere to having open meetings?
As you know, there's an Attorney General's opinion that the Board of Bar Examiners is not subject to the open meetings rule. The board has indicated that it will exercise its discretion as to who may attend its meetings. In fact, at the October 19th meeting, just barely 3 weeks ago, Mr. Steve Levine was in attendance at that meeting. The meeting in question with Mr. Moncada, the board chair at that time felt that it would be disruptive to have any outsiders in that meeting, and therefore he did not allow any in attendance. If it's up to the discretion of the board and the board chair if he intends to open the open session of the board meeting.
Well, I'm aware that Section 19, whatever it is, 32 for meetings, is that the right one?
82.
It doesn't cover the court, as I remember that statute, that rule. But it has been the practice of this court that all of its boards, committees, commissions should comply with the purpose of the open meeting rules, which would include closing them for privacy, confidentiality, and other exceptions. We've never taken the position that that a notice has to be posted, et cetera, and that all of the rules set forth in Chapter 19 had to be followed. But the general rule followed by all of the boards and commissions has been open public meetings.
Yeah, and the board understands that and has made that determination in that one particular case that it would close that meeting. And that was a decision of the board chair in discussion with the rest of the board members.
As you know, the court itself holds open administrative conferences.
Yes, ma'am. And I'm sure the board will continue to exercise its discretion most wisely and favorably and keep them open as necessary.
You're an optimist, Mr. Kasapa.
Probably.
With justification.
Mr. Right. Kasapa, could I ask, there was an assertion by Mr. Moncada that under today's standards he would have passed. Can you address that for me, please?
The scoring for the board and the bar exam has changed over the years. For the 2007 bar exam, the board did make a change in the scoring process. Prior to 2007, the passing requirement was an individual had to pass a minimum of 5 of the 8 essay scores with a minimal scaled score of 129 and a combined score between the essay and the multi-state bar examination score of 258. And then if he met the minimum, passed 5 of the 8, and got the 129, he also needed to get a 129 on the MBE to give him a 258. For 2007, the board looked at that and in an attempt to revise the scoring, the board eliminated the requirement of 5 of 8 passing and the minimal 129 and required a combined score of 258 for passing, which was the combined score previously. So an individual can now theoretically score a 123 on the essay portion of the exam, and if his MBE is 135 or higher, he will have achieved an aggregate score of 258 and consequently have passed the bar exam. The board periodically reviews its scoring requirements almost on an annual basis and has indicated that it will look again in the early part of 2008 as to the scoring standards. I think
what are the criteria for changing your scoring standards?
I'm sorry?
What are the criteria for changing your scoring standards?
The board talked with the psychometric experts at the National Conference of Bar Examiners. They had previously dealt with some of the people at the mathematics department at the university, and they were looking at different ways across the country. What they call the cut scores or pass scores have increased gradually over the years. In the past, Wisconsin was 128. Wisconsin had raised it to 129. So they looked at a variety of factors and sought to look at, see if changing those numbers would increase the pass rate and by showing competence of the applicants taking the bar exam.
Okay. Do you still have Mr. Moncada's paper, his exam from the last time he took it?
No, ma'am, we do not. They are destroyed after 1 year.
What about the concept he has of appealing to the board for the scoring? Now, it's my understanding that you have an internal review if somebody wants to check their examination, and that a member of the board will sit and meet with that person and review why they got a particular grade and show what an exam, what it was the expected exam response.
That is correct. Bar exam is not the same as appeals of administrative or civil claims or criminal prosecutions. With the bar exam, the applicant either demonstrates he's got the competence or he doesn't. Our scoring and grading system is a holistic approach. The questions are obtained from qualified practitioners in various fields. They're reviewed by our board. They're sometimes sent back to the drafters for revisions and come back to the board before they're finalized. In addition to the question, the question drafter provides an analysis of the exam and a grader's guide. Now, that grader's guide would indicate, for example, that in order to meet minimal competence, that 7.5 raw scale score, the applicant needs to meet points A and B. To get to the next level, he needs to get A, B, and maybe C and D. To get to the next level, maybe A, B, C, D, and E. And for a perfect answer, you know, maybe all the way to F. Now, some applicants, and when they go through the calibration exercise, the graders look at this, and through their first 20 questions, they're saying, well, a number of people, or maybe a majority, are missing A and B. So maybe we need to adjust what the minimal competence level is, and they do that. So, theoretically, an applicant who may have answered A to be minimally competent but missed the key point of minimally competent B but maybe got C and F still hasn't demonstrated that minimal competence. And that was shown on the last bar exam with a property law question where a number of individuals missed the fact that the deed did not identify the grantee with specificity. If they missed that key point, the rest of it just didn't follow. From that grading standpoint, they're scored, and any exam that scores less than a 7.5 is then the cover is turned back, along with a number of exams that had a passing score, and they're given back to the original grader. So he doesn't know whether that exam that he's reviewing a second time was one that he gave a passing score to or one that he gave a failing score to. So he reviews it de novo to see if it met the minimal criteria for minimal competence. And he can consult with his partner at that time if he's got a serious question when he does put the second grade on it.
When I was on the Board of Bar Examiners, we had as a practice that anyone who was within, and I can't remember the exact number, X number of points of passing, those exams would be taken out at the end and carefully examined again with the intent that wherever possible give the applicant the benefit of the doubt. You still do that?
The process at this time is that the original two graders will review the exams. It doesn't go to the panel of full graders that are there.
But do you just pay special attention to those that are nearly passing in your grading system?
The graders would use their discretion, and if they see someone has a 7.0 the second time around, they would consult with their grading partner to see if there is something missing or if they can. But again, we believe that we should err on the side of caution in protecting the public. That if that minimal competence level has not been demonstrated there.
Okay. All right.
As to appeals, the fact that other states have appeals does not necessarily follow that Wisconsin should do that, because an appeal to someone who would review an exam several months after the fact, not having gone through the calibration exercise, and not being under the same conditions as standards as when they were originally graded does not lend itself to the validity and reliability of the grading process as when they are done at the same time. And for that reason, the board feels that there is no need for an appeals process, that the current process is such that it affords the greatest level of confidence in the reliability and validity that the scores that are being graded are legitimate scores and doing the best to protect the public by those attorneys who can demonstrate minimal competence.
And Mr. Kasabuki, when do you expect that your proposed rules are going to be adopted?
The board has voted on the proposals at the October 15th meeting. They are in the with the Rules Committee now to be finalizing the language to be put in the form of a final petition to come before this court. Based on the volume of work, because it looked at the entire Chapter 40, the appendix to Chapter 40, it also looked at Chapter 31, which deals with continuing legal education, and the appendix. And the board's intent was to submit a complete package. I would sincerely doubt that they would be able to have that ready as a formal petition before the early part of 2008.
That would be January, February.
Yes, ma'am.
Thereabouts. Okay.
What do you anticipate to be the administrative impact of your, looks to be, new rule? The rule that I'm referring to is that three times, the number three is going to be removed. What's the administrative impact with regard to your proposed rule? And then what's the administrative impact with regard to Mr. Mankata's suggestion that there be unlimited ability to take the bar exam?
If the proposed rule to eliminate or to provide unlimited bar exam passage is ultimately approved by this court, along with the other proposed rules, because they are proposing rules affecting licensing of foreign legal consultants and...
But just stay with this one.
With this one, there will be an administrative impact. There will be some additional numbers of individuals who would apply for the bar exam. That will place an additional burden on our staff as far as processing the applications. There will be additional burdens in doing the character and fitness investigations.
How many per year, roughly, are second takers of the bar?
It would vary from exam to exam. I believe for the July 2007 bar exam, I believe we had three who were taking it for the fourth time. But the other number of repeaters, I don't know.
What about the February exam, which is the more likely examination for a repeat, at least for a first-time repeater? You said there were four out of roughly a couple of hundred? Couple of hundred?
We tested 225.
Okay, couple of...
215.
All right, I wasn't far. 200 plus, okay.
Right.
And how many in the February bar? The
February bar exam was typically between 110 and 115.
And how many would be more than first takers there?
Probably 10 to 15, I think, would be between second, third, and fourth attempts.
So you're talking about a total number in a year of 20, 25.
Potentially.
On the basis of past experience, which may not hold in the future. Okay.
We have a term in the Army, we call it a swag. And that may be within it.
Swag. I'll remember that. It may come in useful sometime for me. Okay.
Not to be confused with swagger, I think.
I'll look it up. Okay. Does that answer your question? Justice Bradley.
If I may, Chief, what's the difference in administrative impact between what you anticipate your new rule will be on this issue and Mr. Mankata's suggestion on this issue?
If he applies to take it again, should the should the rule change or at the discretion of the board, his application would be processed as with the other applications. They would go through our total administrative process of reviewing all the information on his application, comparing it to previous applications that he submitted. Any changes or additions that have occurred since that last time. Some applications are very clean. They go through relatively quickly. Others take months and months to review and validate. But there would be some additional administrative impact and reviewing additional applications that come in.
Mr. Kasabuki, is there anything else you'd like to tell us?
In summary, again, the retroactivity of a proposed rule would not work, and personally, I don't feel it is fair. But then, ultimately, I find that there is no valid evidence that the current Supreme Court rules relating to the bar exam, either as to the number of times that an individual can take it or as to the grading process, are inequitable or unfair. On the contrary, I think the passing rates of the bar exam show that our graders take their responsibilities seriously while assuring that only qualified, competent applicants are admitted to the bar. People of the great state of Wisconsin can rest comfortably knowing that their best interests are being protected. And for all these reasons, I thank you for allowing me this opportunity to appear before you.
Thank you, Mr. Cus. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
A bar exam, am I correct that a bar exam consists of two parts?
Yes, sir. There's an essay portion on the first day of the exam, which would be Tuesday, typically 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon. And the Wednesday is the multi-state bar examination portion of the exam, which is 100 multiple choice questions in the morning and 100 in the afternoon. Again, given over a three-block period in the morning and afternoon.
Does an applicant always take both parts?
Not necessarily. If an individual has passed a bar exam in another jurisdiction with a multi-state bar examination score of 135 or higher and requests to the board, he can waive out of the MBE portion of the exam and just take only the essay portion of the exam.
The fact that someone has might have passed a bar exam in another state, would that have any effect on the number of times they could take the Wisconsin exam?
No, sir. He's still subject to the same rules.
Unless he comes in on foreign license.
Unless he comes in on foreign license. But if he has taken and passed a bar exam in another jurisdiction, is a jurisdiction with which Wisconsin does not have reciprocity, or he has not practiced the minimal amount of time in that other jurisdiction, he has to take the bar exam here. And he would still be subject to the rules. He can take it three times as a matter of right and appeal to the, or file a request with the board to take it a fourth time.
I thought you were experimenting with a third aspect of the bar, but now my memory is failing me. Was it an essay, writing essay, or was it a practical part?
Your memory is not fading you, Chief. The board will be looking at using what they call a practice test,
okay,
which is a kind of a practical part of the examination where the applicant is given a scenario as working in a law office and meeting with the client, and he's given statutes, samples of previous documents, and then has to either provide a draft contract or a draft memo to the senior partner. He's given all the materials in the packet to provide that information.
And what number of your essays come from the multi-state essay pool rather than devised in Wisconsin?
That varies from exam to exam. I believe for July we used four of
the eight.
Four of the eight.
From the multi-state?
For the essay portion of the exam.
Yeah, that's what I meant, but from the multi-state pool of essays.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. We used four.
All right.
Currently, I've got on tap for July 9 possible questions drafted by Wisconsin lawyers. So we try to provide a mix at each exam.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Moncada?
Thank you, Judge.
Wait a minute. Mr. Moncada, somebody has raised his hand, and so that you are able to respond to everybody. Mr. Boykoff?
I would like to provide some information.
First of all, you have to come to the podium. Could you state your name?
My name is Thomas Boykoff. I'm a member of the Board of Bar Examiners, and I thank you for appointing me to the Board of Bar Examiners. I'd like to give you some information about two matters that have been discussed. One, the number of times a person can take the bar exam. And two, the open meetings question that arose. One, there is a rules committee of the Board of Bar Examiners, and I'm a member of the rules committee. And the rules committee meets and goes over the whole Supreme Court rules relating to CLE and bar admission. And we've made recommendations to the full board. The next process is going to be that after the board approves what the rules committee submit to it, or as amended approves, they're going to put it in the bar Wisconsin lawyer so that a public hearing can be held and that we can hear from members of the public on various sections that they're interested in. But now, a recommendation on the number of times a person can take the exam is to delete any reference to number three. If any person does not pass the bar exam after three or four times, they can ask the Board of Bar Examiners for permission to take it again. And if they can make a case, the board will grant their request. But we are recommending the elimination of the three times and plus one if you make a good case. Secondly, open
meetings. So do you favor Mr. Moncada's petition as to that aspect?
Yeah, we have no, the Rules Committee has no objection to that provision.
Okay, you have no objection then to eliminating three times.
Correct.
The Rules Committee. All right. And do you personally?
I personally think it should be eliminated. But
should be what?
Eliminated. The number three should be eliminated.
Okay, thank you.
Issue number two, open meetings. Dean has championed the cause of open meetings many times, and he requested approval to sit in on a meeting of the Board of Bar Examiners. That request was granted, and he did, in fact, sit in on a meeting when we were going over some of the rules, but when we were going to go over certain materials, such as individual applications, character and fitness, things pertaining to an individual, we would not have let him stay for that.
You view those as confidential and privacy issues. Okay, go ahead.
The Rules Committee is going to recommend to the board that we adopt an open meetings rule. And that allows the public to come and observe what we discuss. And we will put a notification on the board's website as to when the next meeting is and where it is. And we will also put in a rule to not permit the public to attend when we're discussing a specific individual application. Which may involve a lot of very personal information.
Sure.
So
you might look at the Judicial Commission for that.
Pardon me?
You might look at the Judicial Commission. It does that. It goes into open meeting and then closed meeting when it deals with particular issues, I assume, relating to particular people. I don't know what they're doing.
Yes, I'll get the copy of what they have and share it with our group. That's all I wanted to say regarding the number of times the exam.
Thank you.
Mr. Boykoff, a question was asked of Mr. Kasabucky about how soon we could expect these proposed rule changes. What is your estimate?
Well, my estimate is that the rules will be ready to present to Wisconsin Lawyer magazine to call for public hearing in the early part of 2008, possibly in March or April.
Just so we understand the procedure. If you are presenting a petition to this court, the usual procedure is to present the petition. The court puts the notice in the Wisconsin Lawyer. The court has a hearing like this one. And then the court has an open administrative conference. That's one way of handling this. Or the board may want to get public or lawyer input before it has a petition to the court. If the BBE wants its own open discussion by non-BBE members, then it might do that. There's nothing that would prevent that. So in response to Justice Process' question, and you're saying that it'll be ready in January, February, is it going to be ready for it to come to the court, or are you still going to be having open sessions to better inform you all about the rules before it comes to the court?
The latter. Yes.
So in January, February, you may be having your own open proceedings to determine whether the rules need further tweaking.
Well, more likely March or April, but yes, you're
March
correct.
Or April to, before you. So you're not coming to this court before. If that's March or April, then you have to reevaluate the rules. You're not coming here before next fall.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
Roughly. Even if you come in May or June, we're not going to put you on the calendar.
Our purpose of having a meeting, or rather having an open hearing for public input, is to, if somebody calls our attention to something that we had not thought about, or they object to a rule for a reason that we had not thought about, the board wishes to consider that objection.
Sure.
And discuss making an adjustment to the rule or not making an adjustment to the rule.
Okay.
So we want a more of a polished product before we submit it to the court.
How should be commended on being open and seeking input from others.
Thank you. I'll pass that on.
Good.
Did you have a question, Justice Bradley?
Justice Bradley.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Boykoff. All right. Does anyone else want to appear? Mr. Moncada, you have the final say.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Just a couple of quick comments. In regards to the testing, the process, I made a mistake. The worst thing I could have done is taken the exam when I lost my son. That was a terrible mistake on my part. But when I took it the fourth time, the frustration came. I missed it by 5/10. And I just want to address the interview process as far as evaluating the exams that you asked, Mr. John. Is when they have that, you request to them to look at your exam. It has no educational benefit whatsoever. You go into a room, they give you the exam, and they give you a sample exam, which they said that they looked at. There's a few scribbles on the exam when you do the blue sheets. There is no event. There's no. You can't ask anybody anything about it. No one knows because there's nothing there. There's scribbling marks on it, so it has no educational benefit. So when you go into that room, you're sitting there with a sample copy of the answer, and you're looking at your exam. That's it. You can sit there all day. You cannot make copies. You can write notes, but you can look at it. It has no educational benefit. And he addressed that. The court needs to understand that it gives no benefit whatsoever.
It would seem to me that if you looked at your response and a model response, that you could do the comparison and see where there were defects.
I tried that. I was 5/10 away on two questions. Mm-hmm. I had sevens. I needed 7 5s. Would have gave me seven mm-hmm. out of 8 questions I'd have answered. Mm-hmm. And another frustration is when I talked to Mr. Rankin, who was the director.
Right.
As you have in your documents, I asked him about the process and so forth, and the response I received is that Wisconsin's psychometrically superior in grading. I have no idea what that is or what that means, but that was his analogy to tell
sounds
me.
Sounds good.
It sounded wonderful. I asked some of the people in education and professors. They had no idea what that was. He said he must be a psychiatrist, and that's the only thing he could think of. But that added frustration. I just want to make your comment about open. I had the honor of meeting this court in 2004 at the Board of Bar Examiners, and I listened to that. And when I asked for reconsideration, all the justices know reconsideration is done in all the courts all over this state all the time. A quick example, in Waukesha County, there was litigation of hospitals for 5 years. And guess what? After 5 years, after reconsideration, they're building a hospital in the city of Oconomowoc. But when I went to the Board of Bar Examiners, they called the police on me, saying they closed the meeting, and add insult to injury, I'm saying that I can't attend it, and that there's three Capitol Police officers standing there. I said, all I want to do is attend the open meeting. And I'm told, you're done. We're closing the session.
I read that because it's in the materials here.
Yes.
The folks from the BBE have indicated there may be change afoot. That is, that there is a proposed rule that may come before us. Can you respond to that? Why shouldn't I say, in response to your petition here today, well, you know, why don't we just wait and see what happens with regard to the possible proposal on the table? Tell me why I should or shouldn't wait. What's your thoughts regarding the possible proposal removing the limitation of three?
Thank you. I go back to the reasonableness and fair. Right now, it's grossly unfair. They're going to change. They're going to make an attempt to change it. But I think it's better when you have 31 states who do not have diploma privilege, have no limitation. It makes no sense to me. Why? Again, reasonableness. Why would you limit someone from taking a bar exam? And as far as administrative costs and fees, I present to the court, you're going to pay. If you take the exam, you're going to pay. It's $450. You're going to pay for every exam you take. I don't see where that's a problem. Fair and reasonableness. And again, I go back to, and this is nothing against the University of Marquette, but when you have 4-, 5-, and 6-year part-time programs, how do you evaluate somebody who never takes an exam, who has to take an exam, and misses it by 5/10, and as of today's standard, passes? That's what I'm saying, fair and reasonable. I don't see how no limit hurts anyone. And I hear constantly as far as protecting the public. How are you not protecting the public? I mean, I said I made a mistake in that, but you go forward. Someone who doesn't pass the bar, they should have the opportunity to take it again. They shouldn't be restricted when you have a whole other people who don't take it at all. And again, I go back to the fair and reasonable aspect of it, and I hope that answers your question.
Are you in support if they're proposed? Do you know what their proposal is? Do you understand?
You know,
and if you're not, then don't jump on board something you don't know what it is. I'm not totally sure I know what it is.
No, and unfortunately, I just received their response this morning. I didn't get that prior, so I know they had changed the grading, and so I knew that. But I really don't know. It sounded like from what the gentleman had mentioned is that they're going to eliminate the three, but I don't know what the process is after that. I just don't want to get in a situation or have anyone in the future. And Wisconsin's a great state, but why would you limit someone to taking the exam? And I go back to the Department of Regulation and Licensing. When you have pharmacists, accountants, everyone else who's licensed, there's no limitation. Why are lawyers being limited to taking the bar? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Mr. Moncada?
I'm sorry, Justice Frost.
I'm sorry to be a little obtuse here, but you said in your initial statement that the score had been reduced or the scores had been changed, and then Justice Ziegler asked a follow-up question on that to Mr. Casabucci. I'm sorry. Would you have passed the current one or not?
Yes, with my score of 142 on the multi-state and the essay score was 127, I would have passed. Today's standards is 123 on the essay question, and it's 5 of 8. I passed 6 of 8, and the MBE is 135. So I would have passed.
Is that disputed?
You can't come here.
Just a minute. Okay. All right. I want you to complete this, and then we can deal with the grading. Okay?
Okay, Judge. I think that's it. I'm just urging the court to look at that. and look at the no limitation and the other agencies and the other states. I mean, they're not doing it wrong if 31 states. Mississippi just came on board this year, so 31. And again, Wisconsin's the only one with diploma privilege. And thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mr. Moncada,
yes,
thank you very much for appearing. Thank you very much for your written materials.
Thank you.
Mr. Kasabucky. I'll try again. It's my understanding that the grading system changes, or at least the numbers go up or down, on the basis of looking at nationally what is happening on these grades, and that's one of the reasons for changing the system. Is that right or wrong?
Nationally, the what they call the cut scores or passing scores in the various jurisdictions have been going up. And the same has been a trend in Wisconsin. Several years ago, it was 126 minimum, then it was 128, then it was 129 on the essay portion. And now it's just it's the aggregate between the essay and the MBE of a 258. You can't compare scores from a previous exam and try to take it and say that you would have passed if that exam were given today because of the differences in exam. On a pure numbers basis, possibly. If his numbers are correct that he had a 123 and had a 142 and consequently his aggregate was over 258, then on a pure numbers basis, those numbers would qualify as a passing score today. But to say that that exam would have passed because they have to be standardized and scaled in each individual case.
Do these numbers indicate, or are they based at all on the fact that probably 85 to 90% of the people are designed to pass? Do you know what I'm saying?
The board has never set that a limitation on that. Well, we want to make sure that only 80% or 89% or 70% of the people that pass. I'm sure the board would be happy if 100% pass. We're looking at minimal competence, and we looked at what levels, based on number-wise, can do that. And by scaling it to the MBE, which has additional validity by repeating some of the questions, we can do that.
All right. And that's, in effect, what you're doing.
Yes, ma'am.
You're scaling him to an MBE, which is going to change every year.
Yes, ma'am. That's correct.
That's why your numbers change.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Thank you.
And if I could address one additional point. On the review exams, Mr. Moncada mentioned that there is absolutely no educational benefit. And I find that hard to believe. I've counseled probably a dozen individuals who failed the exams from the time I've come on here. You get out of it what you put into it. I've had people come out of there and say, thank you. I understand where I went wrong. I understand how my answer doesn't comport with the model answer or the best answers that other ones done. So there is some educational benefit to the review process. Thank you.
Thank you. Hearing no other persons who want to make an appearance, I am now closing the hearing on 0704 in the matter of the amendment of SCR 40.04 legal competence requirement. And SCR 40.04, subsection 5. I'll now call the hearing on 07-06 in the matter of the amendment of SCR 13.015 and SCR 13.045, governing the assessment on attorneys for WISTAP. The presenter is Attorney Thomas J. Basting, President of the State Bar, and I'll state the appearances and then ask if anyone else wants to appear. I've got Judge Richards, Attorney Munson, Attorney Levine, Attorney Klopp, and Attorney Perez. Anyone else want to appear? Okay. Mr. Basting.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Tom Basting. I am President of the State Bar of Wisconsin, and I am here to speak in support of the State Bar's petition for two changes regarding the assessment.
Counsel, before you begin, if I might, I would like to personally congratulate the Bar for its study on the needs legal needs of indigent persons in this state. It was a very impressive study showing, if I remember it correctly, maybe 500,000 people who have the need for legal services but cannot afford to hire an attorney.
Civil legal services.
Civil, yes. I'm sorry. This is all civil. I should also congratulate the bar at the Milwaukee meeting on access to justice. That, I think, was very fruitful. Justice Bradley and I attended that, and that it was a very informative and action-oriented meeting on meeting the needs in civil litigation. And I want to congratulate the bar for its work in seeking state appropriation for meeting the needs of civil litigants, and that what was successfully gotten through both the governor and both houses of the legislature was, it still is, I think, $1 million, which we all agree does not fill the entire need, but is an excellent way of starting to try and fill this need. So since we last saw you on this issue, and before we get into the nitty-gritty of your petition, I think we should look at the bigger picture of what the bar has accomplished in this limited time. And the court has been very happy and very supportive of these efforts, as you very well know. So I want to start off this hearing on that foot, and we can go downhill from now.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I hope that's not an indication of what you feel about my advocacy skills.
No, they weren't bent that way.
I appreciate that, and I know all of them.
You will get the message back to the Board of Governors and staff.
Just as a reminder,
all
right. WSTAF came to this court several years ago, as you will all recall, at a time of what was considered at that time the IOLTA crisis, and asked this court to assess every Wisconsin lawyer a sum of money to help alleviate the declining interest rates paid by banks on lawyers' trust accounts. It was a serious crisis at that time, and there was considerable debate in this court on that subject. This court responded to WSTAF's request with the current $50 assessment. As all of you are aware, that new rule unleashed numerous protests from State Bar members and resulted in endless hours of debate at the bar's Board of Governor meetings. In spite of those protests, however, bar leadership was able to convincingly argue that the assessment should not be challenged, and in fact, the Board of Governors recently agreed with the Access to Justice Committee's recommendation that the Chief just referred to, that the assessment should be made permanent. Former State Bar President Mike Guerin appointed a task force to study the issues connected with the assessment, and the task force advanced 6 possible modifications of the current rule to the Board of Governors. And the Board approved 2 of them, which are before the court today. The first is to amend the rule to modify the classes of membership subject to the rule to include all judicial members. As the court knows, the assessment now includes the Supreme Court justices, but excludes other judicial members. So the assessment now actually applies to active members of the State Bar and the Supreme Court justices. The proposal before the court today is to include all judicial members of the bar in that assessment. We haven't heard any protest from
that. Trial court
hold them yet.
Yeah, did trial court judges get notice of this? Because there seemed to be something in the materials that indicated they really didn't have notice of this idea.
As far as I know, this was published in the Wisconsin Lawyer, and I'm...
Mr. Basting.
I think it was.
The judges got the same notice as everybody else did, which
yes.
is what you're trying to say. On the other hand, the court has the ability to communicate with every single judge in this state by email. And there was a slip on our part. The concept was that we would send, since it's so easy, notice to all the judges and could hear from them. Unfortunately, that was not done. But as I was thinking about that, it occurred to me that the bar, probably with the poke of one finger on the key, can also advise all the lawyers who have email addresses of any matters pending. So I would suggest, if I might, that you consider that. The court cannot do that because we don't have your email addresses. But the court wants as much public input and public notice of its rulemaking procedures as possible. And so we send out, as you know, not only use the lawyer, but we send out notices by mail to others who have expressed an interest in what's pending or we think might have an interest, and then we have a standard list, which the bar, for example, is on, whether or not they're the petitioners. So you might consider assisting the court by using your emails to advise lawyers where you think it's something of great interest. Now, this one was, since we would be changing the rules to cover the judges, was our plan. The plan was excellent. The execution left something to be desired here, but did remind me of this. So, I mean, I think that's what Justice Ziegler is referring to.
Thank you. Well, that's an excellent suggestion, and we are capable of notifying all of our members by email, all of those who have email addresses. A few of the dinosaurs don't, but most of them do.
Yeah, well, the last time I asked the bar about that, the estimate was approximately 85% approximately had emails.
90% now. So in answer
that
to Justice
Ziegler's... That was a year
Ziegler's,
ago, so...
In answer to Justice Ziegler's question, I would assume that they would have been notified of this, and so my statement that we have heard no protest from the trial judges is we have had no.
It just strikes me as something they might be interested in knowing more about.
Or they agree that the assessment is appropriate. Yeah, we could take their silence as agreement, I assume.
I'd feel more comfortable if we didn't.
The Milwaukee meeting, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten. What was it? Get on board.
Bridging
all aboard.
Gap. Bridging the gap, was that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the name of the meeting? The one of the suggestions coming from that meeting was that all judges be assessed. How many judges now voluntarily contribute, do you know?
Voluntarily contribute the $50? Number of judges? I don't know.
Well, we'll whoever is going to appear next or on this list, who knows, can tell us, okay? Let's go.
Okay.
Right. Sorry, Mr. Basting.
The second issue before the court is all about freedom of choice. We are all taught in law school, and judges, when they take the bench, are all taught that one of the most important aspects of practicing law and one of the Supreme Court rules is that lawyers and judges are expected to exercise independent judgment in their work on the bench, and also in their private practices. And that's what the second issue is about, and that is to allow lawyers to choose the organization to which they want to make the $50 or more contribution. We've proposed that there be a checkoff where a lawyer can, when he submits, when he signs every year the bar statement that comes out, can have a checkoff that she has contributed $50 to an organization. I've received the and read the materials from WISTAF, the letter to the court, and the materials from Attorney Ebbett from Legal Action of Wisconsin. And I should tell you in advance now that the bar, I'm sure, would be amenable to a procedure where the only organizations that could be checked off would be those organizations delivering civil legal services to the poor who have received grants from WISTAF in the past or who have been certified by WISTAF to receive grants in the future. So we don't get into this argument of the bar deciding, the Board of Governors deciding which organizations would qualify. I'm sure that lawyers wanting to have the choice could say, I want to give my $50 to this organization, that those organizations could be restricted only to those who have been certified by WISTAF.
Counselor, couldn't you also just continue making the payment to the bar and designating it as an earmark to a particular organization? So WISTAF still gets the money, but you want it to go to Organization A or Organization B, and certainly WISTAF could provide a list of organizations that do provide individualized legal services to the poor, and then you wouldn't have any kind of a accountability problem about was the check really sent, did the organization really get the money. Do you think the bar would be amenable to that type of a procedure?
We discussed that issue as a possible alternative, and the only question that I would have about that procedure would be, I don't know administratively whether that could be handled appropriately. I think it could be.
In effect, it doesn't differ from the proposal you just made.
It doesn't really differ. It's either I've written a check for $50 to this organization, or I'm going to check off that I want my $50 to go.
The result is the same.
Same thing.
I think it gets rid of one of the objections was, how do we have accountability? How do we have enforcement if the checks are not written? And I think it totally eliminates that objection to letting an individual bar member choose which organization he or she wants to contribute to.
And I think accountability, I can't imagine that a lawyer would deliberately falsify a document submitted to this court by saying I made a contribution when in fact I didn't, and knew that she was going to be subject, for example, to a random audit.
But why
I don't think
have
they'd
all
give
this,
up their license for
why
that.
Why have all these other procedures, a random audit? Who's going to do a random audit? Where are you going to get the staff? I mean, if you just keep the money going to WISTAF and WISTAF gives a list of approved organizations, you're in the same spot. You don't have an audit. You don't have accountability. You really don't have any of those problems.
And I don't disagree with that. I think it's doable. I just don't know administratively.
Well, WISTAF can probably tell us about
that.
How
would function with WISTAF and whether they could really do that.
This is exactly what United Way does.
I'm sorry?
This is what United Way does. They give you a list of organizations, and you check off the ones that you want your contribution to go to. As I heard your suggestion, it's exactly the same as Justice Rogensack's now. You have changed this proposal. There's a fire alarm in a minute, so let's not all jump out of our seats.
And Chief, if I might, just to set up the next question, I know we're going to get interrupted. I'm going to submit that there is a difference between the proposals, and I'm going to want to mention what I think the difference is. And it may be significant, and I'd like to hear your response to it. But I don't know that I'll get the question out before the alarm.
Well, go ahead. Let's not wait.
Well, here's the problem as I see it. If all the money... I knew that was going to happen. I knew that was going to happen.
I'll try to talk over this.
Here's the concern that I have, Mr. Basting, with the two differences in the approach. When you have individuals that are submitting their checks directly to an entity, as opposed to through a central processing agency, you can run into a situation where you might have, similar to other programs, a lot of money going to particular agencies that may necessarily have already met their budgeting requirements. And so now they have an excess coming in where you have other entities that may fall short of their budgeting requirements, and it would seem to me that their budgets might be in a state of flux from year to year, whereas with a central processing entity, whether it be WISSTAF or anyone else, you can earmark the funds to go from a particular lawyer to the particular entity that the lawyer wants the money to go to, yet still have someone in a central position who can look at the needs of each of the entities to make sure that the budgets are processed accordingly, that the money is processed through the bar accordingly, to make sure that each of the entities out there will receive their anticipated needs from an annual basis. That I see as the significant difference between the two proposals. And I wanted your comment on that and where the bar might be with respect to that, because it seems to me that there really is a difference there.
That's one of the points that the WISSTAF letter pointed out, and it's one of the arguments that Mr. Ebbett made in his response to this petition. But my response to that is that this isn't the only money that's available to these organizations. We have the $1 million coming from the state of Wisconsin. We have the federal grants that go to some of the organizations. We have all of the IOLTA money that is coming in, and so those agencies are able to depend on grants from the other funds that are available. But we think it's more important to preserve the freedom of choice for lawyers to designate what organization their money should go to. And I don't think the impact of this assessment, of this $50 assessment, which generates something short of $1 million a year overall throughout the state, I don't think that impact that lawyers are, wherever they may favor, is going to make that much difference to those organizations, because I don't think they depend totally on their budgets. Now, I may be wrong and I may be corrected, but I don't think they depend totally on their budgets for just this WISSTAF assessment. And besides that, I would have to say in all practicality, Justice Butler, that I think probably a very high percentage of lawyers are just going to opt to allow the assessment to go through the way it's going now rather than writing individual checks.
And let me follow that up. And the reason I raised the concern is that it formerly in an earlier life sat on the board of Legal Action of Wisconsin, and I probably should make that known to everyone. But one of the concerns that we had when the Legal Services Corporation started cutting its budget is that every time the budget was cut, you were essentially, because you were looking at personnel costs, looking at which staff positions you were going to have to let go. And so you were looking at attorneys that would have to be, well, if this is going to be done on an annual basis, if one entity, whether it be legal services or legal action or judicature or whatever, if you have to annually revise because this year you're $50,000 less than last year, well, that's an attorney that's gone, or maybe that's a secretary that's gone. And then the next year you get more so you can go back and you can hire somebody up. It seems to me that there might be some flux if there's not someone looking at the big picture, whether it doesn't necessarily have to be WSDAP in my view, but if there's not somebody that's looking at the big picture, seeing where the grants are coming from other entities, seeing where the grants are coming from the assessment, and figuring out where the dollars are going to make sure that the needs are at least being addressed as the grant awards are being assigned, yet taking into account each attorney's designation, as Justice Rogenstack suggested in her question, it seems that with at least with her suggestion, you get the best of both worlds. You get the voluntary checkoff, you get the attorneys designating where they want the money to go, yet you're still trying to meet the needs of the entities that are out there that are depending upon those dollars. That's the concern that I have. Whereas if the monies just go directly to the entities, and you develop somewhat of a voucher system, in effect, well, some entities, because they may have got better publicity or better whatever, they're going to do well, and other entities are going to fall by the wayside, and you may actually lose some of the entities that are out there practicing law now. That's the concern that I have.
And the agencies that you're talking about, though, still have to depend upon the discretion of the of WIS staff as to the grants that are made. So one year they may not grant any money to an organization, and the next year they may decide that they are going to grant. So there's still some discretion involved there. But I don't disagree that Justice Rogenstack's suggestion on allowing a checkoff is you know, it's as the Chief Justice pointed out, it's really the same thing.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. You brought in a petition that the lawyer would just say, I gave at the office, right?
Yes.
Okay. I heard you say that having read the comments and recognizing some merit in them, the bar would be willing to have a $50 paid to the bar as it is now, with a statement on the bar dues saying, and I want my $50 allocated to the following, and you could check off and even do a percent. And the following would be entities that WIS staff supported in the last 2 years.
Well,
that's what I heard you saying.
I didn't say, and I said those organizations that WIS staff has given grants to, or
right,
who may have certified that they're entitled to grants.
Well, that's a little different. But
that's what I said.
Okay, that's fine. That's why I want to get that. So the $50 would still go to you. You're the administrative center for the money, but there would be an allocation by the lawyer, and it could be actual entities that have received money, or you can name your own if it would fit. Okay. So the bar is willing. Is this a formal amendment to your proposal? Is it an alternative if your proposal doesn't get the requisite 4 votes? What is it?
It's not a formal amendment. It is a suggestion that saying to this court that if the court so deems it appropriate, that the bar would feel that it's a procedure that they could live with and could go along with. And I say that because the basis of the argument for this petition was to give lawyers a choice in the organizations that they wanted to donate to.
So you get it to any of the WIS staff ones, and then if there's a volunteers in probation in XYZ County that gives legal aid to indigent, you could name that too. for United Way, which has of Madison, which might have a box that gives legal aid to indigents?
I'm not sure I am.
Well, you said that you would allow the checkoff for any entity that WIS staff gave money to.
Yes.
Or any entity which would qualify under WIS staff's rules, which is an entity that gives direct legal services to the indigent, right? That opens it up.
It opens it up,
right.
But
okay.
It opens it up to those entities that
right.
the staff would,
so,
would certify.
I just made up an entity.
Right.
I don't think it does give legal aid to, but suppose it did, the XYZ Community Fund of Marathon County that has one of its entities is the Legal Aid Society of Marathon County. So you could give it to the United Way for that, or you can give it right to the Legal Aid Society of Marathon County.
Yes.
Right?
Okay. I want to follow up on that, because this area is the area that makes me a little nervous. And so I want to make sure we're talking about the same thing and there's a clear understanding, so there is not a response from some who might disagree with what the court ultimately does. So I want to make sure we all are on the same page. Tell me what you think you are saying with regard to WIS staff denominating the types of organizations that will be listed on this piece of paper. Tell me what you envision.
What I envision would be a list of organizations that WIS staff has already certified as having been worthy of receiving a grant under WIS staff's rules. In other words, the organizations that deliver civil legal services to the indigent. Mm-hmm. That if there are organizations that WIS staff has certified, and I say this not having full knowledge of exactly how WIS staff operates, but they may have a list of organizations that they say these are organizations that are worthy of receiving a grant, but we have not yet given them a grant. Those are the organizations that I would envision being listed. And I say that because Attorney Ebbett's argument of being careful as to who you allow the checkoff to go to, because people could organize an organization that maybe did not meet the requirements that the bar and this court envision being worthy of receiving these funds.
So you envision an listing of the actual name of an organization, and there is no place for a line that says other and fill in the blank.
Correct.
So anyone, any organization that is possibly a potential recipient, that name will appear on the piece of paper as an alternative.
Yes, that's what I would envision, and I say that without knowing what the administrative issues would be. I'm told it's doable.
Well, I'm not so sure. The WIS staff gave money to the Legal Aid Society of Door County and the Portage County Legal Aid Society, plus Judicare Legal Action of Wisconsin, Disability Rights of Wisconsin. There may be 10 other counties that have legal aid societies. How can WIS, do you want WIS staff to then list all 10 of the other, first find out which ones are around, and then decide whether it fits the criteria, so that your list could be 50 long, 100 long.
That's
your
pushing
problem.
This.
I know.
I hear the two of you
very
saying
different. Exactly.
Something different, and I want to make sure there's a meeting of at least two minds in this room.
Right. Or mind and a half. Right.
What I would envision, and I'm kind of reacting to this off the top of my head here, would be a list, for example, on a separate page that would accompany the due statement. And from that list, the lawyer could designate on the due statement and write in, this is the organization I want the money to go to. Out of this, from
this list. The problem is making that list. If you expand it beyond that which WSDAC already supports, there may be dozens, there may be hundreds, there may be five, but I'm confident it's more than five. And so I'm not, I don't know how WSDAC, frankly, but they can respond, how they can make up a list. I mean, you have Disability Rights Wisconsin, you might have Domestic Violence Rights of Wisconsin that support domestic violence victims in civil cases.
Mr. Basie, years ago, when trial court judges would sentence someone, we could designate, for example, you'll make a $50 contribution to DARE. And that was routinely happening. Then there was an issue raised as to whether or not those organizations are organizations trial court judges should be doing that to, and whether there's favoritism or you're picking a certain organization or how that's working. So then they enacted the laws relating to crime prevention organizations. And there were certain criteria that they had to meet in order to qualify as a crime prevention organization. And then those organizations, by February of every year, had to report to the clerk of courts who contributed, in what amounts, explain their expenditures, explain how they continue to qualify as a crime prevention organization. And then they could stay on that list, and judges could use that as a tool in sentencing. And so it was kind of a double check there. First off, the judge wasn't picking a favorite, and second off, there was this balance because the organization then had to report back, these are the people that have contributed, and here's how we continue to qualify. That might be something that you would want to take a look at to see whether or not there is something similar where you could outline certain criteria, which they did in 973-06-1F, and then 757-17 are the reporting requirements back, and 753-40 talks about the judge requiring certain contributions. But I would think that would be somewhat analogous and maybe instructive so that everyone knows their organization has a fair shake here. They're not being excluded unreasonably or just because they aren't on one entity's list, but if they fit the bill, that they could qualify and that there's this balancing because they then report who contributed in what amount and what they did with it.
In this case, as I understand it, WSDAF does employ a fairly extensive, serious vetting process now for these organizations to qualify for the grants that they pass out. And so, you know, I think it's a good suggestion to look at what goes on there, but I think that this process is currently in place with WSDAF.
Mr. Basting, I've got a very different question. When this matter was ultimately approved by this court, the rule that was, an order that was issued, was very restrictive. It was restrictive in the sense that the money could be utilized only for direct legal services to the poor. That meant no class actions. It meant not used for administrative purposes, but very definitely restricted. Is that the same understanding you would have under your proposal?
Yes.
Well, WSDAF audits. My understanding is WSDAF checks to make sure that that money was appropriately used.
Yes.
As you know. And as you know, the court has met with WSDAF members, and that's one of the things we ask about, not only grants, but what are your evaluation of those grants, of the use of the money, and are you getting your money's worth out of it?
Yes.
I don't know how WSDAF can do that with dozens more entities potential. One, as you pointed out, you can't check them on the front end as to what they're really doing. And two, how do you check them at the back end after they've gotten some funds? And I think one of the issues in the, what's it called, CPO, crime prevention organizations, is they can file this stuff, but nobody is looking at it. I don't think anyone is in charge of making sure that what is filed is an accurate reflection of what the organization, what is actually happening with the money of the organization. That's one of the issues here.
Yeah.
And I think that the court system is seeking repeal of that statute, just in case you want to look at it. And you might find out there must be some note on it that explains whether or not it's been successful or unsuccessful in auditing. That's all I can tell you about CPOs.
Well, it goes to the clerk of courts, but the clerk of courts staff doesn't go out to the individual organization and double-check what they submit in their report.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
Mr. Basing, I see a distinguished judge in the audience, Judge Richards, who is going to be representing Wisconsin Judicare.
Yes.
I would suspect it would be unethical for Judge Richards to write to all the members of the Wisconsin Bar, urging them to check off Wisconsin Judicare as the one to get the money. But he could call up Brett Favre and have Brett Favre write to all the members of the Wisconsin Bar, please check off Judicare when you get your dues statement. And that would be true even if it wasn't on the dues statement. Make your $50 contribution to Judicare, and then you don't have to pay the $50 assessment. How do you respond to that?
I thought about that. And I'm not sure I have an answer, Justice Prosser, because I know what you're saying, and that is any of these organizations can go out now and can solicit, as I understand it, from lawyers contributions to their organizations. They can write to you, they can write to me now and say, please send us a check. It probably would not be inappropriate for them to suggest to lawyers that they should favor them in the checkoff system. That's the best answer I can give you. I don't think, unless there is something within those organizations themselves or if there's some other controls I'm not aware of, I think they are free to do that solicitation. And I don't see any problem with that.
Well, I think the Justice Butler was suggesting the pot may be limited. Now, I think you countered that quite effectively with $1 million and NAOLTA and the other things. But I think there's a concern that the pot may be limited. And to the extent that one entity gets more of the limited pot and other entities, it seems to me one very likely reaction is that the pot isn't big enough. Maybe we should increase the assessment. I don't think this is a laughing matter. I think this is almost on the table.
I'm sorry, Justice Prosser. I didn't mean to laugh at you.
You were laughing at me.
No, you were laughing at me. What you said is a difference.
I prefer you to laugh with me rather than at me, but that's nothing new. So.
the question is, are there enough funds available for these organizations under these circumstances, or because lawyers will be given the choice as to who they want their $50 to go to, should that $50 be higher?
You don't have authority to propose that today, do you?
No, I
don't.
Just have
checking.
I don't
know
authority.
If it's on the table.
I don't have authority to propose that, other than to tell you, as I did, that the Board of Governors did agree with the Access to Justice Committee that the $50 assessment could be made permanent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think That was a substantial, substantial concession by the Board of Governors from their original position in response to this assessment.
Mr. Basting, that caught my ear, and I've been debating whether to ask that this question, but this is the second time you said it, so I'll ask it. Is this, in your opinion, a recognition from the bar that, in its view, irrespective of the proposed gains that we're going to see with the legislature, that from the various sources that are out there, that there is no opportunity to obtain the funds necessary for legal services to the poor in the civil area from outside sources? Is this basically the position that the bar is in right now?
You mean that there's...
And the reason I'm asking the question is because I think when we voted on this a couple of years ago, I don't think the court was looking at it in terms of whether or not this assessment was going to be permanent or not. I think the whole point of generating this was to start the discussion, to get the legislature to act, to try to get other entities to respond to meet the legal services needs of the poor that were out there, and that we were going to reassess this down the road. It caught my attention when you said the bar has already reached the point where, at least from the bar's perspective, this should be permanent. And I'm just wondering, is this a recognition that we just don't think the legislature or other entities are going to respond so that we have to keep this around, or is there still a hope that perhaps these other entities can respond and we can try to obtain the money from the sources that
No, I think it's, a recognition by the bar and the Board of Governors on behalf of the bar that the bar is very, very serious in its quest to assist in whatever way it can to provide civil legal services to the poor and to those living at even above that poverty level, who have been some 500,000 people in Wisconsin who have been identified in the Access to Justice Commission study that was done. And it's a recognition of the bar's responsibility to assist. But to further, and as far as my quest personally as president of the bar, is to do everything I can to find more money outside of what the lawyers are doing for this purpose, and that means meeting with the business community and reaching out as much as possible to obtain those funds.
I'm not sure I remember whether the study gave a dollar amount of a minimal that would be needed. Did it say, hey, we'll need 16 million, 18 million, 20 million. Somehow the number 16 stands in my head, but I'm not sure I remember that.
What the study did point out was that the funds of our, talked about our funds given by our sister states for this purpose,
yeah.
And that ranged anywhere from $6 to $16 million a year. And,
right.
And those were the ranges of numbers that were discussed.
All right. Now we've got you with wanting to increase the number of persons covered, not only covered judges, but it covered inactive status. You don't want to do
no,
that?
No,
you're still eliminating inactive status.
It would still exclude emeritus and inactive and would only cover active members and judicial members.
Isn't that funny? I didn't read it that way, but maybe I have to
it's
look at it again.
Confusing because it referred back to
another
rule.
Yes. That's what bothered me, so that's why I'm checking. So the only thing you're changing is adding judges.
Yes.
Reserve judges, too? I hadn't thought about that.
If they are...
Mr. Richards
if they have
is a reserve
status.
Judge. Works. We just saw him up in St. Croix County, so we know he's working. But he's on reserve anyway.
Well, he's there.
All right. So it's just judges, okay,
yes.
Whatever that means. Okay, Court of Appeals, too.
Yes.
And, okay, fine. But everybody else stays exactly where they were.
Yes.
All right, got it. Now, the second thing you want is this freedom of choice, but you'll settle for some sort of checkoff system.
Yes, we believe that an appropriate checkoff system that allows lawyers to choose would be appropriate.
Okay, and then there's an issue of whether it's can be effectively done if it's just a total list of several hundred, if we have to get to that. Okay, what else do you want today?
That's all, Chief.
That's your Christmas wish list. Okay.
Well, I'll be back before Christmas.
I'm glad to hear that, Mr. Basin. Before Christmas. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Your name has been taken in vain, Judge Richards. You may appear first because you're first on my list, representing Wisconsin Judicature.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Justices, I haven't seen you for a whole week. So.
All right. Are you going to pay the $50?
I personally would, but I can't speak for my brethren.
Okay. All right.
I have a hunch.
Just
there might
checking.
Be, there might, you might encounter some opposition from them.
All right. But, okay.
As I stated before, my name is C.A. Richards. I'm chairman of the Board of Directors of Wisconsin Judicare. I've served on the board since 1968 or 1969. The years are running together now. So, Judicare started in 1966, and it was a program that was basically initiated by the state bar with under the impetus of Phil Haberman, the director of the state bar, and Don Omelia, who was president of the state bar. And it was intended to get the North Country to meet a substantial need in the North Country for civil legal services for low-income people. And They succeeded on that. We, of course, have been and continue to be the most effective way to deliver legal services to low-income people in the North with the geographical distribution. We run from Portage, Wood, Marathon counties to Douglas, from St. Croix on the west to Marinette on the east. So you can see driving 300 miles is one of the alternatives if you had a non-Judicare type program, but it is working very effectively. We do have our staff office in Wausau that works well. We have the continuing problems, as Justice Butler indicated. Our major funder has been, for many years now, LSC. We have experienced substantial cutbacks, as have other programs. We have worked well, I think, in recent years with legal action in Milwaukee. John Ebbett has appeared at our board meetings, and Rosemary Albert has appeared with legal action. I guess the main concern, just cutting the chase here, would be the potential for dilution in the funding to Judicare. The North Country is a little different than the rest of the state. I know they used to kid me. I know Tom's wife comes from the North Country, Shawno, and its needs are different. Its accessibility to funding, I think, is different. But as Rosemary Albert pointed out in her written submission, it says one of the things we like about the present formula by WISDAF is that it takes into consideration the geographic and demographic factors in making the funding decisions, which ensures equitable distributions. And I know court was up in St. Croix County, but St. Croix County, possibly Marathon County, and a couple other counties in the north are somewhat economic anomalies. When I go out as a reserve judge and sit in these other counties, there is a great need for a Judicare-type program for low-income people. I mean, we see this needs. We see it in landlord-tenant consistently. We see it in domestic family matters. We're seeing it in bankruptcies now. So our concern is, I guess, basically would be the problem of dilution of funding. And that's we feel that WISDAF, the consensus of the board at the last meeting was that WISDAF, what they're applying right now with their considering geographic and demographics is something we like because we are concerned there would be a potential dilution in the funding. And it's been some, we've had some rough years with the severe cuts we've had in LSC funding. And the WISDAF funding has allowed us to expand our programs in this last year or two. It's really been beneficial to Judicare. But I guess that's it. And for the sake of redundancy elimination, I guess I'm not going to make any further presentation, but if there are any questions, I'd be happy to entertain them.
I would just like to say I think JudiCare has been one of our success stories in this state, so should thank yourself and the board for doing this and all of the others involved, including the state bar.
We have to thank the attorneys from the private bar, which is a substantial part of our program, private attorney involvement. Mm-hmm. And because to get to some of these remote, I mean, you go to Burnett County or Bayfield County, you're going a long ways. And if you had a staff program at Wausau, it's very difficult for them to do it, whereas these people can go out and hire an attorney in their own area. Mm-hmm. And it's, in effect, they aren't well reimbursed. It's $45 an hour they're paid. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a partial pro bono program they're participating in.
No. Well, you convey our thanks. Do you want to say something just?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you can tell us approximately how many people were served in the last fiscal year by JudiCare.
Oh, boy. Where's Rosemary Elbert when I need her?
you can get us advice.
I think they estimated our low-income population, which I think I'm quite convinced is conservative, was 90 to 100,000, I think, with staff, I think, in their study. But I'm not certain on that. We've served, I guess the biggest problem is we turned down so many, particularly in family matters. We've been able to expand with the WIS staff now beyond cases of documented physical abuse. In other words, sheriff's reports, doctor's reports, hospitalization, to cover other areas of abuse, financial and economic, but not totally cover it. I mean, there isn't enough money to go around. There is a great need. This is true throughout the state, though. I mean, legal action's encountering the same thing. And we're hoping, I think several of the people are going to be very active at the Equal Justice Eisenberg dinner this Saturday night in Milwaukee. And that's been a way of obtaining some funding, too. Those are the two major programs. I mean, we talk with legal action primarily and JudiCare.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you in Milwaukee on Saturday.
Okay, very good.
Attorney Earl Munson, President of WIS Staff.
My name is Earl Munson. I'm appearing for the Board of Directors of WIS Staff. Let me take a moment just to remind you, if I could, of what the Board of Directors consists of. There are 15 members of the Board. Three of them are appointed by the Chief Justice, and 12 are appointed by the State Bar President with the approval of the Board of Governors. Of those 12, three are not lawyers, and the remaining six three are not lawyers, the remaining nine are lawyers. Currently on the board, of those nine lawyers, six of them have served substantial terms as members of the Board of Governors. And of those six, four of them have run for office as president of the state bar. You might say maybe WIS staff is the place where they put old lawyers who are not successfully run for state bar president. Or you might say that these are the lawyers that represent a larger interest of the state bar on the board. However you look at that, I'll look at it the second way. However you look at it, every opportunity I get to talk to the court or to the bar or to Tom Basting or anyone else, I continually say that WIS staff board does not want to get at odds with the state bar. We need to cooperate with the state bar. We're not here to be at a war with the state bar, recognizing, of course, that there are some members of the Board of Governors who aren't happy with this staff. We don't want to go there. With respect to the issues here, I'm not going to repeat my letter. Let's go to the checkoff discussion that you had. And there is a difference between the petition which said that if you give $50 to the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee, all you have to do is tell the bar you did that, and therefore you don't have to pay the $50. There's no way of accounting for that. There's no way of us monitoring the use of the funds in any way. If, on the other hand, the funds are a genuine checkoff. That is, the $50 comes in to Mr. Brown, and they tell them tell the state bar on the list that it should go to the Milwaukee Legal Aid Society. Now we know at least that the $50 assessment has been allocated by that lawyer to the Milwaukee Legal Aid Society, and they're paying it not because it's a contribution. They're paying it because it is an assessment. We can account for that, but we can account for that in a delayed way and in a fairly non-economic way. In September, October of this year, the WIS staff board decided all of the grants for IOLTA. They do that separately, and then they decide all of the grants for the WIS staff funds. And as Justice Crook said, we don't charge administration. All of those funds that come in are allocated. But during the summer of this year, all of the grant applications came in. Each grant application says why we want the money, how much money we want, what we're going to use it for, et cetera. We make the decisions in September. We now tell each one of those agencies for whom we have given money, here's how much you get from IOLTA. Here's how much you get from the WISDAP, from the assessment. You now can put your budget together for the calendar year 2008. And to the extent that we do not collect all the IOLTA funds, we still meet our commitment. We have a reserve necessary to do that. We may take care of it the next year, but we have the reserve and we have the commitment, and they can count on it. They can count on that money. If, on the other hand, it goes to the checkoff, and let's deal with the checkoff in which the money actually comes into the state bar, designating it for Milwaukee Legal Aid. Now, we don't know that until the following year in July when the dues come in. And we can then say again, in September of that year, okay, last year you got X dollars from the checkoff. We will look at the entire $50 assessment. We will say, here's how much money we would normally give you out of the assessment, and we can take out for what you happened last year. Now, they may not be the same the following year, but it's not really a good way to run a business. Now, I understand the freedom of choice, but the choice is freedom of choice versus economic use and targeting use of funds.
Counselor, doesn't Madison Community Foundation do just that? I give them money and I say, you know, I want this to go to the Boys and Girls Club, or I want this to go to something else, and I give it to them, but they send it. And I don't see why it's difficult for WIS staff to do the same thing.
I didn't say it was difficult. I just said that we would be doing it based on last year's contribution, last year's checkoff, and we would be then saying, theoretically, it seems to me, we would be saying, we believe we are going to get $850,000 this year from the dues. We would normally allocate to you of that Milwaukee Legal Aid, so much money out of those dues. But because you got last year on the voluntary checkoff X, we'll give it to you that much money less the checkoff.
Yeah, but couldn't you just move it back 1 year? I mean, you don't get the checkoffs until after you have made your decision, but it's just going to be 1 year late in what you're doing. You don't have to subtract anything. You just give it to them the next year, don't you? By the time you get the dues, say you get them in December, just an example, and you're going to make your decision before that in September. So you don't know what they're going to say in December. Fine. But the next September, you will know what they've said in December. So it seems to me you're just 1 year behind, and then you're on target.
I understand that.
Once it gets going, you aren't behind at all.
Mr. Munson, I'm not certain of that, and I want to press you on that, because my understanding is that the dues are payable every July.
Yes.
You're going to be sending in the statement when you pay the dues.
Yes.
Correct. And you're going to be making your decisions in September?
We make our decisions in September. September, maybe early October, but yes. For the following year, for the following calendar year.
For the following calendar year. So why wouldn't the checkoff that's made in July for those dues apply for your determination for the funds that you're going to disperse in your January vote? Maybe I'm missing something, and I'm just trying to follow the business side of it. So.
We are anticipating the funds that come in July of 08 that will be used.
Is that how you do it?
Distribution, yes.
Got it. Okay.
Right. What you're really doing, Mr. Munson, other than the timing issue, is does the $1 million from the state go to WISDAF?
Yes.
Okay.
We'll have to work out a contract with the state, but we've had such contracts in the past.
You're going to give Milwaukee Legal Aid the same money you would give them anyway. You would just use the checkoff for the dues plus whatever you had from the assessments plus whatever you had from the state. I mean, you'd make it all up. I mean, United Way knows what it's going to give each of these people, and they give me a freedom of a choice, but they've decided the entity I'm going to give to is going to get $10,000. They're going to get, if they get $10,000 from me, then they're not going to give anything from anyone else.
We can do it.
Yeah, you can do it. Sure. It's just a matter of a year difference, but you can do it. But I don't know whether you can... If you can list all the entities you've given in the last 2 years since you've begun the assessment, but how can you list every entity in the state that would qualify?
I'm sorry, say that again.
You can list all the entities you've given.
Let me talk
about
that.
That's easy. That's the one we talked about with Mr. Basin.
On September of each year, use that month, we decide... Who should get money for IOLTA, and who should get money under
you can list those for a checkoff, but can you list umpteen dozen other entities that might qualify, but you've never given money to?
But that changes. That could potentially.
Sure.
It's a new decision each year.
Right.
We may. We don't. We try not to fund agencies that are doing a good job, but theoretically. Each agency is up for grabs, if I can put it that way, each year.
So the larger ones you'll probably keep funding because they've been for a long time, and unless they get into trouble, you are going to do that. But Door County, you might not. You gave a small grant
County
there.
County, in fact, has been up and down.
Portage County, you might not. But Marathon County might come in.
Right.
Right?
That's correct.
But how can WISDAF be able to determine without having a grant request made to it, how many other units there are in the state that might be eligible for a grant, and how can you audit them if each of us gave $50 to some entity that you don't know of?
We can.
Okay. That's my question.
So the bottleneck is what just Justice Crooks talked about earlier, or at least I'm using that phrase, that the organization has to provide it's only for the direct legal services. So lots of do-good organizations, but if they don't have that component, they're not going to get the first base.
Generally, that's correct.
That's right. And this is the next part of the bottleneck. They have to have applied for a grant from WISDAF.
Yes.
Yeah.
With substantial paperwork.
And
paperwork justifying their request. And each year, after a grant is made, a member of the board of directors of WISDAF, along with the staff, go back and meet with those grantees.
Check and evaluate.
We evaluate. Yes. Now, let me add one other issue that we put in the letter, and that is that presently, the funds that come into WISDAF from, for instance, Dane County, my county, are in excess of the funds that are distributed to that county. We are a wealthier county. We have more lawyers than we have, at least WISDAF has decided we have more lawyers than the need as compared to, say, inner city of Milwaukee. To the extent that there is this checkoff, there is this potential imbalance, the loss of the targeted use of funds. Now, can we deal with that? Yes, to the extent that all the money comes to a Dane County agency out of the Dane County lawyers, can we say, okay, we're not going to give you any money this year. We're going to take that your money we would normally give to you and give it somewhere else. Can we do that? Yes. But it's another hassle. And it is something else that we have to take into consideration, that we do not let the lawyers in the wealthy areas contribute only to their area and not use the fund. This is, after all, a statewide process, and we ought to be concerned that it is a statewide process, not just the inner city of Milwaukee, but northern counties of the state as well. That's my comment.
Any questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Munson. And I don't know if we've arranged yet for the court to meet with staff, but we will. We've done that, I think, at least 2 years, maybe three so far. Thank you. Our next presenter is Stephen Levine, past president, State Bar of Wisconsin. Morning.
Morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Steve Levine. I'm a lawyer from Madison. I'm here speaking for myself on this issue. 3 years ago, when I appeared here before the court, when the court was first considering whether to adopt the Wistaff $50 assessment proposal, I made the argument that I hope the court would not do so because I, as an individual, wanted the dignity and respect to be able to choose for myself where I wanted to make a contribution and what priority, whether it was to a legal charity or whether it was to a non-legal charity. The court made its decision, and that's fine. But I want to, on the basis of the same argument, support the State Bar's petition because I feel it's very important for each individual lawyer in Wisconsin to have the dignity and respect to choose for him or herself where that $50 is going rather than Wistaff. I don't see any large administrative difficulty in the State Bar's proposal. But as far as the alternative is concerned that has been mentioned, the checkoff, I don't think that would be a problem, and I think it would fit all interests if there would be, in addition to certain listed groups on the checkoff, a box at the end that said other, because I would hate to see that the checkoff limits those organizations to whom an individual might want to contribute. An organization might not be on the list approved by Wistaff or the State Bar. So I don't see an objection to the checkoff if there's an open end at the end where somebody could.
What about Posse Comitatus?
Oh, come on.
Is that an okay other?
I don't think they're in the business of providing free legal services to the indigent.
Well, they're awfully busy, or used to be awfully busy in the legal world. I don't know.
It's by courts.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, the point of my question isn't per se towards Posse Comitatus, but other types of groups. Let's say groups that are organized solely for class action, which would be inconsistent with one of the initial intentions. How do you monitor that? How do you control that?
Well, I think what you do is watch what goes on for a few years and see. I mean, there's been a lot of speculation about what's going to happen as to all of each of these alternatives that has been discussed here today. And I think the only way that you really find out is to adopt one of them and then monitor the situation for a few years and see. I think Mr. Basting was entirely right when he said most people are probably going to just have their money go to Wistaff, and that's going to be that. So it's going to be a non-problem, really. But for those few people who want to make the choice for themselves, let them make the choice, monitor the situation, and see if there's something that should be changed after a few years.
Mr. Levine, isn't that kind of the period that we're in right now with the initial grant of the assessment? I thought this was adopted by the court with the idea that we would revisit this, we would look at this down the road. We would hope that it would spur the legislature into responding, and we understand that that may now be taking place, that there is a proposal in the budget to advance $1 million towards legal services to the poor. So in looking at the big picture, are we jumping ahead too quickly? Should we wait and see how this plays out before we start tinkering with it?
Well, I really don't think that this is much of a change in what the court did a few years ago, because the total amount of money that's coming in is still going to be the same, whether it goes to WIS staff or whether it goes directly to a specific legal services group. So I don't think it changes the situation really at all.
Well, I'm talking about with the addition. I mean, we've got the WIS staff assessment, with the assessment money that's in, but now we're going to have additional money supposedly that's going to come in through the state. And there may be other sources. Tom Basting has talked about going out and trying to raise private funds. I mean, the whole point of the assessment was to try to generate that approach throughout the state and get all of the parties active in trying to provide legal services to the indigents, which it seems to be happening now. And so if that was the whole point of passing the assessment, and we were going to revisit that, I guess my question is, should we start undertaking major changes as opposed to minor changes before we see how all of the different aspects work together in providing legal services to the poor? That's the concern that I have. I guess my concern is that are we done with all of the additional sources of funding that are going to come in, that are going to provide services to the poor? Has WIS staff shown to be an ineffective means of supervising the process so far? Are there ways that we can take into account voluntary contributions without making major change to the system? Those are the kinds of questions that I have.
I don't think that this proposed change is inconsistent with what you're saying. In fact, this proposed change, if a person is given the choice of where he or she can directly contribute money, you might get more than $50 contributed by a person in that kind of situation. But I don't think this type of change really is going to have any effect on generating more money and more enthusiasm.
Mr. Levine, was the 2005 assessment temporary?
I mean, everything is temporary, really, but I thought the court pretty well made clear that it was going to be permanent.
Didn't we have a review time?
Yes, we did.
We had a review time on this one, I think.
But I don't think we used the term temporary per se, but no.
There was a review time. In the future, that's my recollection, when we took the vote.
Yeah. Okay. That's right. We said we review it in the future.
That's right.
Did we say that in the rule?
We said it was...
Well, you know what? Let's not decide here without looking at the rule. We can look at that anyway.
Well,
go ahead.
It seems to me, my recollection is we may have said we'll take a look at it, but I don't recall any language saying it was going to expire at any time. In view of that, what is the significance of the bar saying that, we agree it can be made permanent?
I think there was a consensus on the Board of Governors that the WIS staff assessment was a good idea and that it should continue.
That was one of the recommendations in that study. And I think you opened that conference, if I remember. Is that right? Yeah. That at least there be a fixed, even though it's limited fund, it could be counted on. On this assessment. Well, we'll see what happens if people are given a choice. Maybe they'll say the first 100 can select their own charity. After that, you're stuck with ours.
So pay your dues soon.
Exactly. Then the bar would get in a lot of dues early. What do you think of that, Mr. Levine?
Any incentive is fine.
Good. I knew you would see the light. Thank you. Would you like to say anything else?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levine. Mr. Klopp of the Legal Action of Wisconsin, the board president, and then we have Ms. Perez. And I would say to you, it's about almost noon. The court has a meeting at a few minutes after noon, so we would like to put both you and Ms. Perez in before we leave, and then we'll come back to discuss these matters after lunch, which would be about 1:45. Okay? Mr. Klopp.
Well, my name is Roger Klopp. I'm an attorney in Lodi, Wisconsin, and I'm also president of the Board of Directors of Legal Action of Wisconsin. I'm here primarily to speak in opposition to the changes with the exception proposed, with the exception of the change to include judges and having judges contribute the $50 dues assessment. We're fully in favor of that. Now, one of the big changes is that no longer would the dues assessment be distributed by WISTAF, but it would be a checkoff of some sort where a person could either nominate, a bar member could either nominate an organization where the money could go to, or, as I heard modified today, that there could be a list of organizations approved of by WISTAF, and people could, bar members could check off which one of those people, which one of those organizations the money went to. Now, I see some major problems with that. For one, there hasn't been a problem with WISTAF doing it. WISTAF has been in existence for quite some time. Has a mechanism for evaluating organizations to see that they are appropriate for funds to go to and that they are using the funds appropriately and continues to do that. If WISTAF was not, or some other entity was not there to see that these different nonprofit organizations where the money could be donated to ensure that the organization is actually doing what they say they do, it could really destroy the whole effect of having a dues assessment at all. And a second part of that is the way it goes right now. The money goes to WISTAF. WISTAF uses their experience, evaluates applicants, and looks at how much money they've given to them in the past as to where to allocate the money. If there was a competition which was developed between legal service providers because there is an ability to choose from one entity or another entity or a third entity as to where the money would go to, all of a sudden you would have Wisconsin Judicare lobbying members that more money should go to them as opposed to Legal Action of Wisconsin or Disability Rights Wisconsin expending time and energy lobbying state bar members that money should go to them as opposed to the program up in Superior where the money goes to. So I think all of a sudden it creates a competition, would create a competition between legal service providers in order to get the dollars, and that would be an inefficiency in and of itself. Now, I think that allowing individual attorneys to allocate their dues assessment would be inefficient in other ways as well. There, I think, is a reasonable possibility or a probability that numerous entities would spring up to try to get a share of the money which is out there. You could have the Columbia County Bar Association, a family law program, or other entities like that spring up and ask to be certified by WISTAF as a provider of legal services, and then they would try to get attorneys to donate money to them as well. And one
Mr.
thing
Klopp,
which may...
What about Mr. Basting's point that I think he began his discussion by indicating that from his perspective, he didn't foresee a problem from the board. Obviously, the board hasn't voted yet, but he didn't think the board would object to utilizing the various entities that have already been approved by WISTAF, which would protect the concern that you raised that, you know, you'd get other groups creating these organizations to try to take the money out of the system that might not necessarily go for the purpose intended. Given his statement, wouldn't that solve your concern with at least with respect to that aspect of Legal Action's position?
Yes, it would, but not completely. If it was only the eight entities which currently receive money from WISDAF right now, that would be fine. But who's to say WISDAF has to have some sort of threshold of organizations which receive the money? And at some point in time, an organization could say, look, we provide legal services the same way Legal Action does, the same way Judicare does. We should be certified to receive that money, too. And I think it would be, WISDAF would be hard-pressed to say, no, you don't, and we aren't going to consider your application.
But perhaps let me press you on that for sake of argument. I know, for example, Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee is not on this list. All right. And I can envision that they might qualify under any criteria that would be set forth, including criteria set forth by WISDAF, although I would leave that to WISDAF or whatever parent organization. And I think if I hear Mr. Levine's position accurately, his point is, look, what's wrong with me saying I want my $50 to go to the Legal Aid Society? I think they're a good entity. I think they do a good job. I would just assume that they have the money that I submit. And when you hear an argument made in that context, I guess I have to press you, what would be wrong as long as it met all of the criteria that was set forth by WISDAF or whatever entity would be supervising it? And I want to relate the question because if it's ask it just like that and it's taken out of context, it might force an answer in one way, and I don't want to force the answer. What about doing it in that context, keeping either WISDAF or an entity like WISDAF in place to look at all of the funds that are available so that they can assess, all right, the pot has been diminished by so much for these various entities, but we know what's left. We know that these entities have traditionally received money. We understand the needs of these entities, and we're going to make our allocations based upon our past practices with the pot that's left. Putting all of that into the equation, what's wrong with Mr. Levine's position?
Well, I don't know everything which WISDAF looks at to qualify an applicant and how much money they give to that applicant. But I do know that they look on what they've given in the past. If you advocate for a legal service provider de jure model, which is what you mentioned, that they might be popular today, and you have 150 or 250 attorneys donating this year their assessment to that particular provider, and then the following year a different provider de jure, which is popular, which has some program which has come up in the news or something, could get their money next year, all of a sudden it gets yanked from the previous provider. And it creates an inefficiency in the system because you have great increases and decreases in funding for the different organizations and which are inefficient. There's an efficiency of scale and also an efficiency for continuity of service. And if you have to hire a new attorney 1 year because you get X number of extra dollars, and then you have to discontinue it the next year, there's wasted time and money in doing those things. And so I think that is inefficient.
Okay. Mr. Klopp, anything else? I don't want to...
Yes, I wanted to address one last thing. With I guess, somewhat disappointment, maybe in my own profession, I have to disagree with some of the comments made by Attorney Basting as to the willingness of all the attorneys in the state of Wisconsin to donate the $50 to the assessment. If it is a strictly voluntary system as was proposed in the rule, I think that you would see that a certain number of people would not actually make the contributions which they said they were going to make. And part of that is maybe because they disagree with having to do that, but also part of that is I think that people have a lot of good intentions, and
they don't always follow through on their good intentions. And their good intentions would be to make a donation to a legal service provider, but they may not actually at the end of the year do that. And under the proposed rule, there was not an oversight or enforcement mechanism to guarantee that all of the attorneys actually made that contribution. Also, another oversight problem which I saw was who determines what legal service provider is actually a legal service provider. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klomp. Ms. Perez?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Laura Gramling Perez, and I serve with Mr. Klopp on the Executive Committee of Legal Action. I'm also in private practice in Milwaukee, and I know that our morning is running long, and I'll certainly not seek to repeat the very articulate comments others have made, including Mr. Klopp and others.
We appreciate that.
I have no doubt you do, Your Honor. I'd like to point out very briefly that I perhaps don't entirely share Mr. Klopp's pessimism about our legal profession. You all no doubt know that many, many attorneys in Wisconsin contribute far more than their $50 assessment each year, both in the form of cash and in the form of pro bono services to a variety of civil legal services programs. Those contributions are very appropriately made on a personal level. Individual attorneys make very personal decisions about which organizations they wish to support and which organizations they wish to become involved with. In my mind, the WISDAP assessment is a different animal. The WISDAP assessment is a joint effort on the part of the entire legal community in the state to come together in order to, I believe the words are something like, elevate the administration of justice in the state, and frankly, I think by doing that, elevate our own profession. And I think it is important that we view that pot of money, that somewhat less than $1 million a year, as a joint effort on the part of the legal profession. As such, and that is a generous pot of money. I think that that's an amount of money that can make some real difference in our state. Nevertheless, it's an amount, it's a small amount in view of the entire need. I believe that the final report by the State Bar's Access to Justice Committee noted or estimated that an additional something like $16 million a year in appropriations would be necessary in the state to meet the legal need that committee identified in its study. And personally, I think that amount may not even cover the entire need. Given the enormity of the need, I think that we have a responsibility as a profession to shepherd our WISDAP assessment money carefully. I think that the WISDAP board has shown itself historically as having done a very good job of that. The WISDAP board has developed considerable procedures to evaluate grant applications, to audit the work of its grantees, the legal services providers who receive its grants, as well as, to ensure that the limited funds that it is able to grant are not used in a way that is duplicative, that these amounts of money are pooled together and leveraged in the best way to fill geographic holes, to fill subject matter holes, and to make sure that we're serving different constituencies as well as we are able to serve them. I do think the proposal we've talked about today to perhaps have a checkoff and allow individual attorneys to target their money to specific WISDAP qualified organizations may well be a reasonable compromise and may well be workable. I'd like to note a couple of comments and concerns about it. First, I think as the Chief Justice's attempts to make sure she's on the same page with Mr. Basting earlier this morning demonstrate, the devil's in the details, and figuring out how to effectively put this in place may be more challenging than we think. Secondly, I'd like to make sure we don't discount the Brett Favre factor that Justice Process pointed out earlier. I do have a a good deal of faith in our legal profession, and I think, you know, overall, we're a number of pretty smart, rational people. I would hate, though, for decisions about where this limited pot of money go to be made partly on the basis of public relations campaigns by different organizations, rather than based on sort of a concerted, careful effort to make sure the money is apportioned carefully. And then finally, as I've already noted, I think that that may be a procedure that would make it difficult to make sure that the pool of the collection of individual contributions are apportioned fairly, are not used for programs that are duplicative, are not used duplicatively, and are apportioned geographically in a way that makes sense and best serves the low-income population throughout our state.
Counselor, don't you think with $1 million that was in the budget that is now going to go to WISCTAF, that if all the lawyers allocated their funds to legal action of Milwaukee, just serving that area, that with the other funds that are coming in, then WISCTAF could, you know, spread those funds out around the state so that the needs would be reasonably met?
Certainly. I think that there is a possibility for that. I think we should proceed carefully and think about what is the overall pot of money and to what extent might individual earmarks tie WISCTAF's hands to some extent. WISCTAF right now, I think, has some leeway to make emergency grants if that might be necessary, and a good deal of leeway to make sure different populations are being served. I think that we should proceed carefully to make sure that some sort of program for individual earmarks is put in place, that does not take on such a sort of size that it might hamper WISCTAF's ability to do its job as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Perez. We appreciate your expedited version of your remarks. Mr. Basting, I don't believe this. Go ahead.
30 seconds.
30 seconds, you're on.
Here's how it works. WISCTAF certifies to the bar a list of organizations to be used on the checkoff list. The bar sends out the due statement with that list. The lawyer is allowed to check off one organization, only one from the list. The bar then sends, when the dues come in, the bar sends one check to WISCTAF with a list saying organization A gets $2,000, B gets $4,000.
Right.
All the rest of it that's left over from those gets parceled out by WISCTAF. That's how it works.
Right. The issue is how many do they have to certify? That's the issue. Or whether you have an other.
Mm-hmm.
No other. And how many do they have to certify? Can they certify the last 10 grantees that they did? That's the kicker, Mr. Basting.
It's an issue, but it could be WISCTAF would make that determination.
Okay. Well, if you're willing to leave it to WISCTAF, that's easy. Thank you. That concludes our hearing on 07-06, governing the assessment on attorneys for WISCTAF, and you were true to your word about 30 seconds. Thank you. The court is in recess for lunch. We will come back at approximately 1:45, and we will then sit in open administrative session.